Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's time for justice. Those were the words of Judge Stephen T. O'Neill before he sentenced Bill Cosby this week to a 3 to 10 year prison term. Cosby was found guilty in April of drugging and assaulting Andrea Constand, but dozens of other women have come forward over the past couple of years to tell similar horrifying stories of Cosby slipping pills into their drinks and raping them.
It always happens when you're 13, only when you're 13 on up to like when you get married.
This is Cosby from a 1969 comedy album, It's True, It's True, talking about a legendary aphrodisiac.
Guys stand around and talk about Spanish Fly, and it never starts with one of the guys on the corner. It's always some strange 13-year-old who says, you know what? You know anything about Spanish Fly? No, tell me about it. Well, there's this girl, Crazy Mary. You put some in her drink, man, she... Yeah, Spanish, oh, yeah, that's really groovy, man. Spanish Fly is groovy, yeah, boy. From then on, man, anytime you see a girl, well, she has a Spanish Fly, boy. Go to a party, see five girls standing alone. Boy, I've had a whole jug of Spanish Fly, light that corner up over there.
There's some creepy foreshadowing. The court case has been unfolding for the past 3 years, but the charges were certainly in circulation back in 2008 when writer Ta-Nehisi Coates covered Cosby in a freelance piece for The Atlantic. But Coates' subject back then was a different matter, concerning Cosby's so-called call-out tour, in which the iconic performer scolded black audiences for self-destructiveness and moral laxity in their communities. The story, which challenged Cosby's assumptions, changed the trajectory of Coates' career. He was unemployed and flat broke at the time. Now he's the award-winning author of several books and all-around national treasure. We spoke to Coates back in 2014 after he wrote an essay of introspection verging on self-flagellation, because as the picture was emerging of Cosby, the serial predator, Coates realized he deliberately downplayed those predations back in 2008.
The piece that you wrote was about Cosby as a kind of moral arbiter for the black community. He was on a call-out tour where he was upbraiding African-Americans for various kinds of failures and setting himself up as a kind of moral guidepost.
Yes.
So that was the occasion for the piece. It was about that. It wasn't meant to be a general profile, correct?
That's exactly right. It wasn't a profile. And that's very interesting you said, because that was the argument made to me at the time by people, you know, around me, very, very close to me, you know what I'm saying, even be outside of our editorial at The Atlantic, about whether to go forward and how it should be written. And it was an internal argument that I had with myself, yep.
So you plan a hunting trip to go hunting for deer. You come across a dead body. You don't say, well, I'm really here to deer hunt, so I'm going to ignore this corpse sitting here in the leaves. Did you ignore the corpse in the leaves?
More what I did was I nodded at the corpse in the leaves. I pointed out, hey, you know, somebody should really do something about that corpse, and kept hunting. That's more like what I did. Because it's in the piece, right? I mean, the problem is not that it's ignored. The problem is that it's sort of, you know, said in a very limp and weak way. Hey, there's a dead body here. Somebody should really look into that. In my world, in my mind, I was writing one Bill Cosby story. And I wasn't, as you say, writing a profile of Bill Cosby. Surely other reporters were going to follow up. Surely there would be other reporting about Bill Cosby. It would not, you know, just be me. I don't know. I was in the world of my story. It was my story. That was the story I was writing. That was the story I was doing.
Well, if you have any culpability as a journalist, probably we all have culpability as the audience do, because I don't think anybody was dying to see Dr. Huxtable trotted out
that's the problem, right there. See, that is exactly the problem. I had none of those illusions. Like, I think other people had to do psychological work to imagine Bill Cosby. I had none of that. That's not what got in my way. Like, I pride myself, like, even in that piece, I thought, you know, hey, man, here's a skeptical, counterintuitive take. This is not what, you know, people are saying about Bill Cosby right now. I'm doing something, you know, different than whatever else you're going to see. It wasn't different enough, though. You know what I mean? Like, it should have been, if anything, like, the lesson for me is you have these instincts, because I did have instincts at the time. Go harder. Always go harder. Always go harder.
Yes, it would have taken you off of the story you had pitched and were assigned. And yes, it would have required a whole lot more legwork if you go back and do your due diligence on accusations and
No, Bob. It would have required me, for instance, to figure out well how I was going to pay the next month's rent. I mean, that's I'm being real with you. I'm not, you know, that again, that doesn't excuse it. Like, that's the work you signed up for. But it's also the work. You know, it also is the work.
Now, you're black, and you are more than well acquainted with the narrative of black sexual predators that have ended in countless lynchings and probably goes to the core of the worst pathologies of racism. Mm-hmm. The idea that black men would defile white women. And a lot of these victims are white. And even as Bill Cosby was going on the stump, wagging his scolding finger at black Americans, he was feeding the core of so much racism in this country. Emmett Till is hanging from a tree limb for looking sideways at the wrong woman, and Bill Cosby is allegedly slipping Mickeys in women's drinks. Ah.
That's not even a connection I had made, but I think you're exactly right. I mean, what, he became every white racist, you know, fever dream. If anything, you know, that called for, you know, even more so for it to be investigated. That's a connection I hadn't even made.
Even now, this is still allegations, and there's no physical evidence. There are no rape kits. There are no eyewitnesses. You know, I suppose there's always the possibility of some sort of hysteria going on. But that's quite a leap, is it not?
It's a big leap. If you think about all of the possibilities, you know, things that people throw out, well, he's rich and he's famous and people make allegations and he's a target. Oh, yeah, well, why aren't there 18 women accusing Barack Obama? Why aren't there 18 women accusing Denzel Washington? There's a lot of rich, famous black people out there.
So you've done this kind of stunning mea culpa. Are you going to stay on the story? I mean, you're certainly not on the Bill Cosby beat. But is there anything you're going to do on the Cosby story to go hard now?
I don't know. I wrote that post, but it's not a conclusion. This is happening in real time. You know, the accusations are coming fast and furious right now. I think we're up to 18, you know, women. And the thing I think about is, for every woman who comes out publicly, how many women are there, you know, who for very, very understandable reasons are not coming out publicly? And for every woman who's not coming out publicly, how many women are there who did not end up back at the hotel, did not end up drugged, who thought Cosby was creepy to begin with? You know, there's so many stories that must be out there.
Ta-Nehisi, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is the author most recently of We Were 8 Years in Power and also Between the World and Me. This interview first aired in 2014.